It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time is Food Friday. This week, we'll learn about kombucha and find out why the fermented tea is picking up in popularity.
Earlier this week, the Census of Employment and Wages ranked Wisconsin 35th in the nation in private sector job growth.
But that same census also showed that Dane County, located in south-central Wisconsin and home to Madison, ranked second in the nation for private sector wage increases.
Mike Ivey joins us now. He's a business reporter for the Capital Times in Madison, and he explains why Dane County's getting high marks in private sector ratings. Mike, welcome back.
Hi, guys.
Well, the census looked at data from September 2012 to September 2013. How much had local private sector wages in Dane County increased over those last 12 months?
Well, they're on average about 9.3%, which is, that's a lot. A good way to put it. Statewide wages were up about 3%. Which is actually not too bad, because nationally wages were up 1.9%. I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you there, but I think the story there is that Dane County, which has kind of been embracing the technology and new economy sectors, has really kind of stands apart from the rest of the state.
Well, let's look at that, because Dane County is outpacing the rest of Wisconsin, and it sounds like what's driving it largely is technology. Can you dive into that a little more and tell us what
technology?
Well, we've
had, I don't know if people have heard of Epic Systems, which is now the largest technology employer in the entire state. They make the software that so many doctors are now using to keep their medical records. Part of Obamacare required that all healthcare facilities in the U.S. eventually convert to an electronic healthcare system. Epic had been doing that before, but they've had a tremendous growth since Obamacare went into effect, and also before that, because people were planning. So they've got over 6,000 employees now working on the Madison Far West Side. Their headquarters is actually located in Verona. So that has had a tremendous impact on the local economy, because those jobs are paying $50,000, $60,000 for people coming right out of college. And then, some of their other people that have been there a while are making a lot more than that. With that said, we should also note that Epic is only about 2% of the total employment base in Dane County. So I think there's been some spin-off development from that. There's been quite a bit of apartment building and real estate investment that's gone on, partly because a lot of these people that have come to work for Epic want to live in downtown Madison near the restaurants and the bars and the nightlife. So that's fueled kind of this boom, and I think a lot of it has all come together, and some of these numbers are starting to reflect that.
So if we do go with the Epic theory, is the idea here that Epic is booming right now, maybe because of Obamacare, and that they're paying really well?
They are paying well, and it's spurring some growth in some other offshoot companies. So there's people that had worked at Epic have now started their own companies, helping people who have the software learn how to navigate through it, and so that's worked as well. Also, what's happened here, too, and I think it's important to note, is Dane County and Madison in particular is home to three large hospitals, and hospitals, medical care in general, has been growing. It continues to be a big chunk of the economy. Those jobs tend to pay pretty well, and that was sort of recession-proof. I mean, people still get sick and go to the hospital no matter what the broader economy is doing. So there's been some growth in that area as well. So, I think this has been going on for a while, but these numbers were sort of validated it. And I should add, too, that some of the people that follow these things real closely have pointed out there may be a statistical quirk at work here that suddenly boosted Dane County up above some of these other counties. And so some of the economists are drilling a little deeper into that. So we may know more as these next round of numbers do come out.
Well, obviously, the rest of the state would love to duplicate what Dane County has shown right now, this 9.3% increase in private sector wages. Is there a lesson that the rest of the state can extrapolate, or is it just the circumstances that are specific to Dane County?
Find an Epic system to move to your community. Yeah, I mean, I think the news here is that Wisconsin wages actually have been ticking up a little faster than the national average. Like I said before, they're up 3%. I think some of that reflects the rebound that we've seen in manufacturing. Wisconsin was, I believe, fifth in number of manufacturing jobs added over this period that the feds were looking at. Nationally, wages are only up 1.9%. I mean, this has been partly a jobless recovery, but in a lot of ways it's been a non-wage increase recovery. So I think seeing the wages start to catch up is maybe what people really need to see. I've always said that people in Wisconsin don't need a tax break. They need a pay hike. And I think that's we have lagged on pay and income for quite a few years. We have fallen behind Minnesota in terms of per capita income and wage growth. And so maybe things will start to level off a little bit. But, you know, the high-paying jobs are in those technology and medical fields. And Wisconsin, for better or worse, has a lot of its economy. It's been rooted in agriculture, in old-line manufacturing, paper-making, forestry, some of those industries that just have not, you know, you're not going to make a lot of money working a lot of those jobs these days.
There is another area that seems to be credited for the hike, and that is education services. We haven't talked about that yet. What falls under that umbrella?
Yeah, that sort of left some of the economists scratching their heads. Whether that was was this a sudden jump in charter schools or Globe University hiring a bunch of people. I think this would be administrative things related to education. But we need to remember that this is private sector stuff we're looking at. So this is not one of the raps on Madison is that it's, you know, you've got the state government there and that's why your jobs pay more. But this is all private sector stuff. So I asked that question myself and that's where they thought maybe there was some statistical quirk. Some reason the feds lump education and health services into the same category. I encourage people, if they're really this interested in it, go to the Cap Times website, click on my story on this, and there's all kind of, you can bury yourself in economic statistics if you want to.
One thing I want to talk about, Dane County, it's different a little bit from the rest of Wisconsin that it doesn't rely as much on manufacturing jobs. What do you know about counties and states that do rely on manufacturing and how that's affected wage increases and job growth?
I think that's why we have seen the wages for the state tick up a little higher than the rest of the country, because those manufacturing jobs do tend to pay better than the some of the service sector jobs, retail, leisure hospitality is always kind of a low-paying industry, restaurant and hotel workers, and even some of the forestry and paper-making jobs. So manufacturing does tend to pay higher, not as high as the high-tech jobs, but it does pay higher than those other sectors. And Wisconsin has, like I said earlier, has had a nice rebound in manufacturing, because manufacturing still is the largest goods-producing sector in the state.
Do you think the job market in Wisconsin, like, say, the stock market, where you get some good news like this and all of a sudden everyone's feeling confident and more jobs and higher wages start cropping up?
It all starts to play together. I mean, all these surveys on employers are feeling more upbeat. We talked last week, I think it was, about the manpower numbers showing, that survey showing that employers are feeling more upbeat. And, I think this wage thing probably reflects it as well. All those things work together to create a better environment here. You know, at the same time, I think there's a lot of politics that figures into this, and people end up blaming the governor or either party not doing enough. But you talk to most economists, and they'll tell you, who's in charge of your state doesn't make a whole ton of difference when companies are deciding whether to add or hire people or to expand or move into a state. I think politicians would like to take credit for things that happen one way or the other. So as much as you maybe want to blame the governor for our 35th performance on jobs, or he'll take credit for Amazon, for example, opening in Kenosha, I mean, it probably is. It doesn't make that much difference, really, who's in charge. I mean, the Wisconsin State Journal had this great graphic that they put together on their website showing where Wisconsin ranked relative to the other Midwestern states. We were ranking a lot higher under Jim Doyle when he was governor in terms of relative, compared to the other Midwestern states. So,
And Mike, we're going to leave it there. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys.
That's Mike Ivey, business reporter for the Capital Times in Madison. The fermented tea kombucha is picking up popularity these days. It's made using live cultures, and some health enthusiasts say it can have beneficial effects on our digestion and our overall health. Vanessa Tortolano joins us now. She's an herbalist and co-founder of Nasala Kombucha. Vanessa, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Kombucha 101, let's start there. What is kombucha for the uninitiated?
Kombucha is a health beverage. It's fermented tea. It's got probiotics, B vitamins, C vitamins, helps your body detoxify and boost your immune system. So it's really good for you. It's got all kinds of yummies in it.
So let's describe the taste for listeners who might not have tried it. And I, just before the show, I did a little bit of homework, and I had a little bit of kombucha. And I have to say, it might be an acquired taste for some folks.
This is definitely not for everybody right away. Especially, you know, different kombuchas taste differently. It's kind of like a craft beer, you know. I can't think of the word right now, but there's different ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So different people's brands taste differently. They have different styles. Our style is a bit different. We try and balance it, but it's definitely got a tart, sweet, and fizzy taste to it. And it has like a bite that kind of hits you at the back of the throat. Oftentimes, and that's the sort of trigger kombucha tang that
right,
everybody recognizes.
The tang. Well, it's something that you can make at home. I think mm-hmm. you've taught classes on it.
Yep.
And given a little know-how and a little time, what goes into making kombucha?
You basically boil some water, you steep some tea, you add some sugar, and then you put it in with a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast, and that's what you use to ferment the tea. And that little guy, we call it a SCOBY. There's an acronym. I can't speak today. This is terrible. but you put that in with the tea, and it ferments. You put it in a jar with a cloth cover on it because you do want to allow it to breathe. And so what it does then as it's fermenting is it creates a new SCOBY on the surface, and that sort of acts as a barrier between the world and the underworld of kombucha and the fermentation and what's happening under there. But it also allows it to breathe. So it is a breathing, living organism. It's pretty cool.
Now, kombucha is gaining in popularity these days, but it goes back a long time. I mean, it's got a long history, but why is it getting popular now? Why the interest in it?
Well, I think people are really, really trying to gain control of their health and their bodies and what goes into their bodies. And people are becoming more and more concerned about, you know, how to take care of your body, how to stay healthy. And so it's in that fermented food category. You know, when you add fermented foods into your diet, you're really helping to balance the probiotics and the pH in your body. And it really helps with digestion. And when you have a happy digestive system, you have a happy body, and then you have a happy mind.
Right, we're hearing a lot about that, aren't we? About the different health effects of kombucha. And I know that people are really big on the probiotics these days, the live cultures. What is the science behind that? Do we know about what is in kombucha and what it does to your digestive system?
I mean, there's amino acids, there's lactic acid, there's glucuronic acid. A lot of the very same things that are found in like kefir and yogurt and sauerkraut are all very beneficial for the body because it does help establish a more balanced pH in your body. Because when you're out of balance with your pH, that's when you tend to get sick. That's when you tend to fall in disease. And so, yeah, having fermented foods in your life is very important and very good for your body.
But what at one point do you separate sort of myth from the science? Because there are all sorts of health claims about kombucha and what it can do. It can cure this, it can cure that. And I imagine there's truth to some of that. But some of that seems like it goes a little far afield. Where do you draw that line?
Yeah, I read on Wikipedia that some Russians used to say it could make you live forever.
Right, the tea of immortality.
Right.
It's the tea of immortality. You know, I sit in the spot of you need to try it for yourself and see how it helps your body, because everybody's body is differently and only you can really determine what is working for your body. Some people drink it and they're totally fine and it makes them feel great. Like that's how it is with me. I drink it and I feel awesome. Helps bring me back into balance. You know, if I'm feeling under the weather and I notice that I haven't been drinking, I'll drink it and I'll feel better. Other people don't feel good when they drink it. So it just really depends. Some people actually get rashes and, you know, it doesn't react well to their body. So you really just have to kind of check it out yourself and see what works for your body. Also, a lot of people don't realize that you need to drink plenty of water when you're drinking kombucha, because it does help your body detoxify. So your body's going to start throwing toxins off. And if you're not flushing that with water, you are going to end up just retoxifying your body.
Let's talk about the SCOBY that you mentioned earlier. We don't have a picture of one up right now, but if you go online, it's easy to find one. It looks like this giant floating mushroom, which
right.
is a little intimidating at first blush. And I've seen them in people's homes when they brew their own kombucha.
Yeah.
Are you freaked out by the mushroom thing?
Oh, God, not at all. I play with those things all the time. We have really big ones, too.
Yeah. And they grow like a giant disc, don't they?
Well, they basically grow to fit the surface of your container. So if you have a square container, it's going to make a square because
okay.
it's sealing off the surface so that the stuff can happen underneath. So, you know, whatever shape container you have is what shape your SCOBY is going to be. And now we have 200-gallon vats. And so our SCOBYs are like 4 feet
big
around
giant
now.
SCOBYs.
Yeah.
Is it essentially like a mushroom?
It is not a mushroom.
Okay.
It is absolutely not a mushroom. Mushrooms do not grow in liquid.
Okay. I've been schooled in mushrooms.
It's a common myth. They call it, yeah, the kombucha mushroom. But it's not a mushroom. It does, you know, it's more of a... It's bacteria and yeast, so the yeast is, you know, kind of fungi-ish.
Fungi-ish. You coined a new word there.
Oh. So at its most basic, it's a pretty simple recipe, but
mm-hmm.
what do you, I mean, like homebrewing, I think of that, it's very basic, there's not much to it, but homebrewers get pretty exotic with trying to add things and make it taste different. Does the same thing happen with kombucha?
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, different people experiment with juices and fruits and different, you know, I've heard of hops and adding, you know, different herbs and things like that. We do herbal ones and we do fruit ones as well, but we can't sell those because it does end up with a higher alcohol content when you use fresh fruits.
Jean looked interested
good
at
tip.
That. So I'm like,
right?
Good tip for the future.
Well, let's talk about some of the different things that you do with your lime, because you've got a whole bunch of different flavors.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about infusing the kombucha with all these different varieties?
We use straight tea, basically. It's a flavored tea, but we use it. It's from Rishi in Milwaukee, and they just have really awesome, great, high-quality tea. And so the different flavors, like the blueberry is a blueberry rooibos. So there's freeze-dried fruits. So all the flavors come from freeze-dried fruits, and they're not, you know, artificial or, you know, sort of shoved in there in the end or anything like that. They're actually steeped in with the tea, and that's how we get our flavors.
What's the most popular one?
Lemongrass ginger.
Lemongrass ginger.
Absolutely.
So that might be a good one if you're a kombucha newbie
mm-hmm.
and you're a little, you know,
hesitant.
If you like about the flavor, but it is very effervescent.
Yes.
It's kind of fun to drink.
Yes.
And I've heard that your company is kind of going gangbusters. Can you speak to whether or not this is really catching on, the kombucha thing is a trend both in Madison and elsewhere?
I think it's done being a trend. I think it's now part of people's everyday lives. 5 years ago when we started, it was nothing but education. We just, you know, we're basically educating people constantly about what it was, what it did, blah, blah, blah. And now people at least know of the word, you know, like they've heard the word if they don't know what it is in particular.
Right.
But most people know what it is now, which is really cool because now we spend more time selling and less time educating.
Which is good, but it also puts up the challenge. What are you going to do, you know, 5 years from now? Are you going to have to trick it up a little bit to keep selling or to keep your business? Or do you see what you have in place now being able to carry you for a long time?
We did choose our new space specifically so that we could grow over the next, well, now it's 4 years. But definitely after that, we're probably going to have to reevaluate. We may have to look at a bigger space or about maybe think of building. It
mm-hmm.
just really depends. But yeah, we have some very big plans happening, and but I can't reveal what those things
right.
are right now.
Well, we are just about out of time, but in our last 30 seconds here, you make cocktails with kombucha, and
yes.
you gave us one which is up on our Facebook page. Real quick, can you tell us what's in it?
No, because I forgot. It's all Jeanette.
It's got PIMS.
It's got PIMS in it. It's all and cucumbers and mint, and it's all due to Jeanette Dainty. I'll just boost her because she's awesome. She's our in-house cocktail events manager, and she's just rocking it and making things really fun for us. And she makes amazing cocktails, and we have a list of cocktails on our website.
And the one out on our Central Time Facebook page is there, too. So excellent. Vanessa, thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Vanessa Tortolano, an herbalist and co-owner of Nasala Kombucha.
And you can find a recipe for the kombucha cocktail on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A few years ago, Peter Sagal, the quick-witted host of NPR's popular Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, hit the road on a customized red, white, and blue Harley Davidson.
Those patriotic colors on the Harley spoke to his mission. He wanted to ride across the country to find out if the U.S. Constitution was still alive and well in America, 225 years after its founding.
Sagal covered more than 2,000 miles by motorbike to find out how the Constitution lived on in America's towns and cities. He recently sat down with Rob Ferret, who asked him why anyone would ride around on a Harley asking people about the Constitution.
There's been an awful lot of talk about the Constitution in the last few years. And although these days you hear a lot of it from the right wing or half of society that the Constitution is being violated or the constitutional principles are being lost, during the prior presidential administration, you heard it from the left side of society. A lot of people invoking the Constitution, saying the Constitution says this, the Constitution shouldn't allow this, this, be what it may, is unconstitutional. And, you know, to paraphrase that old joke about the weather, everybody complains about the Constitution, but nobody does anything about it. Or more to the point, it seems nobody really talks about the Constitution as it is being lived today. And what I mean by that is a lot of times when people invoke the Constitution, and again, both sides do this, they refer to its original meaning, you know. This is particularly true among the Tea Party set, but it's not exclusive to them. They say, you know, our founders never intended for X to be allowed, or our founders believed that Y was the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody talks about it as it's alive today. The founders are dead and buried, as wonderful as they were. And for many, many years, 226 to be exact, since the Constitution was ratified, we, the American people, have in successive generations been living out this Constitution in our own way. It has changed radically, not just the text through amendment, but our understanding of it. And even as we speak, it is surrounding us. It is binding us together. My joke is it's like the Force. And what we, and by that I mean myself and the producers of this documentary, that I did for PBS last year, wanted to find out was how is it being lived now? And what we did was we took that motorcycle, that 2013 Road King, and we rode around the country. And we talked to people who, through intentionally or not, were caught up in constitutional issues, including perhaps most famously at this point, a woman named Chris Perry and her partner Sandy Steer, who were the lead plaintiffs in the case that eventually went to the Supreme Court under the name Hollingsworth v. Perry and became part of the recent jurisprudence establishing in many states, an increasing number of states, a right to same-sex marriage, you know. So these are people who were making a claim. We think that the Constitution allows this. And it went right to the Supreme Court. So, you know, for these people and many people like them in different issues, the Constitution is not just a historical document you can see under glass in Washington. It is alive and well and active. And that's what we wanted to talk about.
Even these people caught up in it, though, do they just see this as a legal issue, a legal matter, or do they feel the Force, to run with your metaphor? Do they feel the Constitution as a living thing?
You know, this is you have to understand, the living Constitution is a term of art that refers to a particular kind of argument. And so I tried to avoid that phrase, although I think it has a lot of truth to it. What I ended up thinking about and talking about a lot is the Constitution is a centerpiece of a civic religion. And what I mean by that is through an analogy to, say, a certain kind of Christian. Or for any religion, but let's take just for the sake of argument a Christian. You might run into somebody who calls themselves a Christian, but if you talk to them about biblical texts, about the history of the church, about the Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels, you know, all the stuff. They may not know any of that. They may not know their text. But they live, this person we're talking about, according to the principles of Christianity as they understand them, which they feel very strongly about. And these may be like, you know, love thy neighbor and turn the other cheek and do charitable works. You can't say that person isn't a Christian because they don't know the works of St. Augustine, for example. Similarly, our country is filled with people, the vast majority of us, who may not know constitutional texts or jurisprudence, who may not know about even Brown v. Board, let alone much more obscure but important cases like the slaughterhouse cases in the 19th century. But they firmly believe that the Constitution guarantees rights, it confers obligations, it means that if we have a dispute, we settle it through legal matters or through elections, not through force of arms. And at first, I thought that people were woefully ignorant, that they didn't know about things like, you know, Griswold v. Connecticut or stuff like that, or Loving v. Virginia, important Supreme Court cases. By the end of the process, I began to really appreciate the fact that what motivates and sort of illuminates this country is that religion, that religious belief in the Constitution and the rights it guarantees. So I think it's more that. They believe in the Constitution as a force in its own good that preserves and protects this country, and I think they're right.
Well, the world is packed with constitutions that were lovely on paper.
Exactly.
And failed in a year to a decade. Is it because they didn't have that lived belief in them, that civic religion acceptance?
Yes. Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the more interesting things that was said to me by a noted constitutional scholar. He said, you know, the Soviet Union had a constitution, had a Bill of Rights. That did. It did. I looked it up. It was a really good one. I mean, it had things in it that would really satisfy just about anybody who was looking for a really well-made government. It guaranteed people all kinds of rights, the right to speech, the right to assembly, the right to forward unions, the freedom of conscience. It also guaranteed them health care and education. It was awesome. You know, it described a utopia. And as we all know, it was a sick, cruel joke played in the people of the Soviet Union for, you know, 80 years. It was a nightmare. It wasn't worth the trees they cut down to print it. So why, you know?
Yeah.
Why did the Soviet Union Bill of Rights was a meaningless joke, and why is ours more or less worked as designed? And it really comes down to that common belief. It has to do with the fact that everybody in this country, from you and me all the way up to the president, believes in this Constitution and will act in its precepts. And if it is violated, we will agree to correct that eventually. Again, I don't want to put, you know, look at our history through rose-tinted glasses. Mm-hmm. There have been intense struggles, painful struggles that cost people their lives to make the Constitution live up to its own promises. But nonetheless, the progress and the reality has been toward making it work. And it's because of that religion, because ultimately we all believe in it, however much we might disagree on its, shall we say, its particulars.
All right. I hate to just keep asking why, but why did we believe in it? Was it something that the founders did? Is it something about the nature of Americans, the weather? I don't know.
It's a really good question. I mean, and it's sort of, you know, you keep ending up, you know, just being circular. People believe in it because they believe in it. And one of the more amazing things that we witnessed when we made this documentary, and it made it into the documentary, I'm glad to say, is we witnessed a citizenship ceremony, mm-hmm. a naturalization ceremony, that's the phrase. And, you know, this was just like the ceremony that my ancestors did when they came here from Russia and Germany at the turn of the last century. That might have happened at a terminal in Philadelphia or Ellis Island or Boston, wherever they landed. Today it was in, or this year rather, it was in Chicago, and it was in a federal building downtown. And unlike, they weren't, you know, Polish and Russian Jews as my ancestors were, or Irish people or Italian people, or these happened to be Mexicans or Somalis, a smattering of Europeans, Eastern Europe in particular, a lot of South Americans, Caribbean people. And, you know, this incredible diverse melange of people and languages and ethnicities, and they all, at the end of that ceremony, were as American as you or I or anybody born here or how my ancestors became after they became citizens. And you really have to ask, what makes these people Americans? There's no shared cultural heritage, right? Like people talk about the shared cultural heritage of, say, Japan or, you know, or Russia. People talk about, you know, the cultural tradition of the autocratic strongman in Russia, which is why democracy has such a problem there. Or democracy in Switzerland, right? We don't have that. We're from all over the place. My ancestors probably didn't have anything in common with yours, and they had nothing in common with the Somali people who just became citizens. But what we have in common is this new, again, I'll use the phrase, civic religion that everybody swears allegiance to, saying, I believe in the principles of democracy as laid out in the Declaration of Independence, that every person, we no longer say man, has certain rights from God or wherever, that those rights won't be abrogated, that we have the right to self-government, that there is a right to redress in the courts if a wrong has done us, that we have the rights to form and unform governments of our own will, that we are committed to this very messy, sometimes very unsatisfactory and inefficient democracy, no matter its costs. And they all buy it. They all accept the gift of freedom in exchange for responsibility to be citizens. They know that part of the responsibility, again, is that if you get angry at your neighbor, you don't shoot him. You take him to court, you know, or if there's a problem, you call the police, that we will participate from the bottom up. And if we didn't, if enough people gave up on it, it would fall apart. The Constitution, I mean, one of the things I pointed out to people is a lot of people said, well, the Constitution prevents, take an example, Obamacare, or the Constitution prevents background checks for assault weapons or whatever. And whenever anybody says that argument to me, and I got a lot of emails like this, well, don't you see that the Constitution clearly says this? I'd say, great, you're right. What are you going to do about it? I mean, you could be right, say. I mean, here's an argument that was actually made to me, so I'll use this one, that the Air Force is unconstitutional.
Because the word Air Force isn't in the Constitution.
Exactly. It says Navy and Army. It says nothing about an Air Force. Now, nobody serious makes this argument because it's obvious. Armed forces is implied, a level of technology at the time, whatever. But you can say to this guy or anybody with any similar argument, great, you're right. The Constitution's the Air Force is unconstitutional. What are you going to do about it? Because as I said to him, and I'll say to anybody else, the Constitution itself is four pieces of parchment, the original version of which is sitting in the National Archives under glass. And you're asserting, even arguing successfully, that thing X, the Air Force, is unconstitutional, is not going to suddenly make that document fly up out of its case like bat wings, go over to the president and bat him about the head until he disbands the Air Force, right? It's just parchment. If you have a convincing argument about what the Constitution says or should say, you have to convince your fellow citizens, enough of them, to change our government so that that change goes into effect. Good luck to you. That's the burden of democracy. And so, I mean, that's what it takes. There's a real obligation to engage, and that's what we all believe in.
That's Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, talking about his cross-country trip on a Harley-Davidson motorcycle to find out what the U.S. Constitution means to Americans 225 years after its founding. We'll hear more from Peter in a minute.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening to Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, sharing stories from his cross-country motorbike trip to see how the U.S. Constitution lives in America today. Rob Ferret asked him what aspects of the Constitution people are most passionate about.
For most people, and I think this is human, they're passionate about the thing that they care about, the particular fruit of liberty that they like the flavor of, if you can follow that metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So people are most passionate about the Constitution when they feel it guarantees them a right for something they want to do, be it carry around an AK-47 or marry their same-sex partner. You know, there are people, and I love these people, who get very excited about the Constitution in the abstract. And a lot of those people end up being lawyers and scholars of the Constitution, and civic-minded activists. They join the ACLU. They might join other legal organizations or advocacy organizations in order to preserve that. But usually it's for a goal. It's because they want our society to reflect a value that they believe in. And that's fine. I have no problem with that because the Constitution doesn't solve our arguments. It makes our arguments possible in a civic way. That's what it's about. It's about you with your passion arguing profoundly that our society should be shaped in a certain way and me, assuming I disagree, arguing passionately on the other side, actively engaged in politics and civic life, so that one of us will win or will compromise and society will change. That's what the Constitution gives us. It doesn't give us the answers. It gives us a way, no matter how imperfect, to settle the question.
A rule book to settle the problems.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you played Dungeons and Dragons where you're growing up like I did.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did I?
We're in public radio. Yes, that can be expected. Well, if you remember, I never come up with this metaphor, but I like it. Dungeons and Dragons, for those who had normal childhoods playing sports and going outside, is a game that is an open-ended game that you play, you sit around, you play with your friends, and you have this adventure, this made-up adventure. And what the rule book does is it gives you ways to settle disputes, right? Mm-hmm. In this case, the disputes are sword fights or magic spell fights or whatever.
Do I successfully whack the dragon?
Exactly. I'm going to whack the dragon, right? So basically, Dungeons and Dragons doesn't tell you what kind of adventure you're going to have. It tells you how you're going to have it. Similarly, the game masters, if you will, the guys who wrote the rules in the Constitution 225 years ago, 226 years ago, didn't know what our national adventure would be. They didn't know where we would go, what we would do, what kind of country we would become, whether we would become an empire or an isolationist country. What they didn't have any idea, mm-hmm. I think, how big it would become physically or in terms of population. What they gave us was a rule book to play this game, here's an old school callback, to choose our own adventure, if you will. And following the rules is really important, because if you break the rules, you can't continue the game, right? If you're playing Dungeons & Dragons and somebody stands up and says, I don't care that I just rolled a one, I still killed him. Well, the game ends, right? Mm-hmm. You have to have the rules to play the game. Similarly, you know, and that to a certain extent was what started the Civil War.
Right. They said, we're going to take our dice and go home.
Go home. I mean, I don't know if I've ever compared to the Confederate, anybody has ever compared the Confederate South and the Civil War to Dungeons and Dragons, but that's essentially what happened. The problem with the Civil War, at least to begin with, wasn't slavery, although obviously that was the underlying cause. It was that there was a national presidential election that happened according to the rules, and the losing side said, fine, we didn't win, we're leaving. That's why it was such an affront to democracy, because the central idea of democracy is no matter what happens, you follow the rules, in this case, the Constitution. No matter what the result, even if you don't like it, sorry, that's the rules, that's the game, try again next time.
Every now and then I'll get a press release from somebody saying our state should secede or it's time for a new civil war for one reason or another. Do you worry that in our lifetimes, even, somebody else might want to take the dice and go home and say, you know what, the rule book doesn't work anymore?
There will be people who say that. There will always be people who say that. Do I worry that it will ever happen? Well, even though I have read a lot of apocalyptic science fiction growing up, you know, Canticle for Leibowitz, anyone?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You and
great
I,
book.
Man.
Yeah. Let's hang out sometime.
Yeah, I know. Hey. Anyway, even though I've read a lot of apocalyptic science fiction growing up and read a lot of scenarios in which the country breaks up, to this day, as you know, there are people who want to break up California or secede from Texas or mm-hmm. whatevs. I don't think it's going to happen, because the tendency of society as our population grows, as our technology improves, is that we are more and more and more and more and more and more interconnected. So, you know, let's take these wonderful people in Texas who say we should secede, you know, from the United States. Really? Do you want to have borders on all, and I speak roughly here, four sides of your state? Do you want to have to, like, change currency when you drive into Oklahoma? Really? Do you want to have to pay a customs fee when you buy something from Amazon because they're based in Seattle? I mean, you know, it's all nonsense. And the forces holding us together, not only, you know, politics, but commerce and communication and family ties, highways, infrastructure, everything in this country are so profound that if these people ever actually tried to take their flapping lips and make them into policy, they'd run into the reality of the country we live in. It's just that we're deeply interconnected. And always will be, because that's where we get so much of our strength and privilege as Americans.
One of the amazing things to me anyway is that we're pretty much using that first run with a handful of amendments. I think Thomas Jefferson said, hey, you guys are going to have to rewrite this thing, you know, pretty often, 7 years or something like that. Why don't we do that? Why haven't we amended it more?
That's a good question. You make a good point. A historian of the Constitutional Convention who we talked to in the documentary said that these guys thought that maybe this would last 50 or 60 years maximum, this country they were building. I mean, they had seen so much change in their own lifetimes, let alone the massive change of the revolution and independence itself. There's something we mentioned in the documentary, that our Constitution, the American Constitution, is the longest active written constitution in the world. There are other ones, but none go back as far. And it is also the shortest by a lot. And that is really related. And I think the reason the Constitution has lasted so long is because it is so short. And what I mean by that is that the founders had the wisdom and the foresight not to lock us into too much stuff, right?
Ah, so we can fill in the blanks a little.
Exactly. They don't, for example, tell us what kind of welfare programs we should have. They don't tell us what kind of laws about what tax rates we should have, right? They don't tell us hardly any of the daily political decisions that a country makes. They say, here's the framework, you guys figure it out, speaking to posterity. A lot of constitutions that have been written since then fill in a lot of those blanks. They call for universal health care. We went to Iceland to talk to the people who were writing a new constitution there, which has since been rejected, and they had a ball. They wrote in all kinds of fun stuff. Not only national health care and retirement insurance, but also laws pertaining to the welfare of animals. They were going to make it part of their national constitution. They couldn't be mean to animals. Now, I'm all for being nice to animals. I think that's a good thing, personally. But I'm really glad that our founders didn't write that or any of those other things into the Constitution. They left it to us. If we wanted to, we could pass a law as a nation making the slaughter of animals for meat illegal. We could do that. We're not gonna. We could. And then we can undo it if such time as we all get hungry for a burger. And that's the genius, that they didn't decide any of those issues for us. They let us decide. And that is why I think it's lasted so long.
Peter, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and I hope to see people tomorrow in Milwaukee at the Harley-Davidson Museum.
That was Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, talking to Rob Ferret. Peter Sagal will be at the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee tomorrow, as he said, to tell more Constitution stories. Find more information at harleydavidson.com or a link on our Facebook page. I got a picture of him in a